Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it's the toy department. A day late, a dollar short this week. I'm Derek Madden, and he's Matt Kolsky. Hopefully not going to actually be a dollar short, but...
I mean, I feel like we're always a dollar short, so...
It's true. I mean, in real life, anyway. But we are... we're trying to do a little mini episode this week, because both of us have some scheduling issues. A lot going on when you're doing sports radio, and it's NFL playoff season.
Yeah, man. Very busy time, and also... this kid, man, he gets you sick all the time. It's awful.
I thought you were talking about Jimmy Garoppolo for a second, but no, you're talking about your child.
I'm talking about my child. Yeah. I'm talking about my spawn.
Your little germ factory, basically.
Yeah, he's a petri dish. It's awful.
So what does he have right now, and what is he giving to you?
Man, well, it's a whole thing, dude. We thought he had... Listen, I don't know what's going on, okay? My wife thought he had croup, which I guess this is like a
cough that
babies get, but they don't transmit.
But not whooping cough?
I never heard of it either. But apparently people who know about babies know about croup. I don't know.
Yep.
And then he was sick for like a week. And then I thought we were safe. And then all of a sudden, like 3 days ago, my wife got sick, and then I was up all night last night, like coughing and swallowing painfully, and I don't feel great. So thanks, kid.
That means it wasn't the croup, though, right? If it's not,
I don't know, man. I don't know what's what anymore. I just know everyone in my house is sick for the second time in 2 months.
Yeah, I don't know if you're now a person who knows about babies, but I know I am definitely not a person who knows about babies. So
I'm a person who knows a little bit about one baby.
You know, you're a person who knows about baby. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And not that much, really. I mean, I have a vague idea of what's going on with baby.
Yeah.
If anything, I am less interested in other people's children than ever before.
There you go. So I don't know if the airborne illness in your house is a good segue into Parasite, but we might as well start there, right?
Yeah.
I freaking love this movie. I've been raving about it. I saw it on Monday, and I've been raving about it ever since. No one I know is going to watch it. It's literally playing at one theater in the entire metro area here. But yeah. I really thought it was an excellent vehicle to explore class and mobility and stratification in an entirely different society. And yet, you know, I mean, look, I'm not going to pretend like, oh, I watched a movie for 2 hours and now I know Korea. But like, I felt transported into Korea in the time that I was watching this movie.
This movie does a phenomenal job of... I mean, not that it's made for an American audience, but for an American audience, I think it does an incredible job of what you just said, sort of transporting you to Korea, specifically by, like, a lot of the stuff that a lot of the people in this film do is objectively horrifying.
In some
way or another, right? Yeah. I mean, it just is.
Yeah. Some of it in the very classic horror movie sense, some of it just in the you know, a manners sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And yet, you really get a deep understanding of everyone's motivations, where everyone's coming from. Like, as wild as some of the stuff that goes on is, you're never really like, well, come on. You know, it's like you are struck by the fact that people seem to be doing what they need to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of that. And I should say, too, because it's one of those things, I feel like maybe I'm doing a bad job of this when I'm talking to people about they should see it. You know, everyone gets that it's, you know, it just won an award and there's subtitles and it's playing at the art house. And like, And I think that that gives you a certain idea of what kind of movie it's going to be. And yeah. It's not that. Like, this is
no
flat out popcorn entertainment. Like, it is a, you know, feels like there's a weight on your chest. I actually even had that, like, that, you know, the stone that the kid gets from his friend.
Yeah.
Like, it almost feels like that thing is on your chest for the whole movie. Like, you were gripped to this family. So,
yes, that stone's an incredible device. There's so much smart, interesting stuff done here, and part of that is the writing.
Yeah.
And I'm not a subtitles guy. Like, I am annoyed and frustrated by subtitles. I generally find that they take me out of a movie. But this is just really good. I mean, the writing is really, really good. It's funny. It's clever. And again, like, you deeply understand the motivations of people who are doing insane things.
It pulls off this really neat trick of being incredibly specific and universal at the same time.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And I would say specific in, on multiple counts. You know, it is very specific to the families that you're seeing, and yet generally applicable to sort of class divides everywhere. It's very specific to Korean issues, and yet easily grafted onto other places. Like, it really works on a lot of levels. It really was just a great movie.
Yeah. It, you know, and look, the guy kind of famously made that speech and had the really great line about, like, you know, once you overcome the 1-inch barrier that is subtitles, there's a whole world of cinema out there. But I like this movie so much, I'm like, oh my God, is this guy right? Like, is there a whole world of, like, Korean movies that are all this awesome that I have no idea about?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's not.
There's probably not, no.
That's the thing. He's right, but also, this movie is exceptional.
Yeah, but what I am doing is going to check out some of his other movies, and I did not realize he made Snowpiercer, which is kind of did a thing.
I really like Snowpiercer.
And I guess there's one of his Korean movies that is streaming on Netflix now, and I'm forgetting the name of it. I'll try to tweet it out or something during the week, but I'm going to try to check that out as well. Because this was great.
The only one I had seen is Snowpiercer. I haven't seen any of his Korean films, but I really liked Snowpiercer.
Yeah, I did too.
And I do think he actually made that. I feel like he made that in Korean first. Is that crazy?
That could be true. And there's certainly some, you know, Korean actors in it.
I think The Host is the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right. The only other thing I want to say is that that house is literally like my platonic ideal of a house.
Yeah, like open floor plan, floor to ceiling windows in the living room.
Yeah, super modern, like really cool sculpted backyard.
Secret murder basement.
They had lots of really great furniture in there and everything too. Like, yeah, I was way into that house.
Still?
Even still with the secret murder basement. And apparently, it corrupts all who enter. But, you know, look, even after all that, the kid still wanted to get the house.
Yeah, that's true.
Spoiler alert, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. I guess
I take it back. Snowpiercer is just based on a French graphic novel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I really liked it, though. Again, I'll say.
Yeah. Yeah, Snowpiercer is great, and Parasite is great, and it's worth the effort. Seek it out.
If there's one thing we can tell you today, it's that driving 20 miles to the one theater in your area that's showing Parasite is 100% worth it.
Yep. It was a nice theater. Glad I went. All right. Let's stay in the movies and jump over to Bombshell, which is another story about Fox News. I think for us, like, we really liked Loudest Voice in the Room. So it's almost a little bit hard to sort of escape the comparison of that, because you're talking about a near time historical event with people who are all living and we all kind of know, and lots of Roger Ailes.
and I dare you to prove to me that Russell Crowe and John Lithgow did not use the same makeup. Because it's funny, having those two things, I have a very a clearer picture of what Roger Ailes looks like than I did before.
Yeah. I mean, we think, right? I mean, look, I've seen pictures of the real Roger Ailes, but
yeah.
Now the impressions in my mind are definitely more Russell Crowe and John Lithgow.
For sure. and I think, all right, so this movie, the first thing I want to say about it is that I really think everyone in it is excellent.
Yeah, particularly Charlize, I thought was really great.
Yeah, but Nicole Kidman also was excellent, and whoever we were just talking about, whose name just flew out of my head, Lithgow is remarkable, I thought.
Yeah.
That said, I'm not sure what we're doing here.
Hmm.
And okay, nobody should be subject to prejudice of any kind in the workplace. Obviously, women are well, maybe I shouldn't say obviously. I certainly think women are the most vulnerable group that is constantly subject to harassment and inappropriate workplace behavior. And there's no excuse for what those women went through, and it's wrong. And I'm glad at least some of the transgressors were punished in some way, although clearly insufficiently.
But
these women are not innocent victims. It's a really difficult thing to draw a line between the active pursuit of nefarious, prejudiced ends by people who are then attempting to stand up for their rights in another arena. Like, it's just, if you wanted to make a movie, if you wanted to make, for this is trite and I'm sorry for putting it this way, but if you wanted to make a Me Too movie, almost any other real world subject would be better.
To me, look, it's funny because I saw this movie with my mom, who listens to this podcast, and I imagine her head is nodding right now as she hears this, because she felt the same way. And I almost think that if you are trying to tell a Me Too story, like, that it almost could be more impactful that to say even these people, you know what I mean? Like, even the people in this world, rather than taking, you know, making your main character or your lens for that story a saint, you know what I mean? Someone who's good and obvious and of course, and you know what I mean? Like, this is right. I know, I understand it's not, there's obviously a lot of space between Megyn Kelly and Gretchen Carlson and saints. But you know what I mean? Like, you could go that other way and make this make it a virtuous person, make it an ordinary person. But couldn't you make the case that in some way it's more powerful to say even these people who have made nastier contributions to our discourse?
Yeah, no, I mean, I get that point. And I certainly stand by the fact that those women are entitled to feel safe in the workplace and are not, do not deserve to be treated the way they were treated, and those men should be held accountable. I don't debate any of that. But again, it's not even a matter of whether or not they're good people. It's the specific disingenuous program that they were not complicit in. They were active participants in deliberately turning people against various groups. You actively participated in persecuting huge groups of this country in a near identical way to how you – I mean, well, not near identical is too strong. But in like process-wise, philosophically, the same way you're being persecuted based on nothing more than factual aspects of your humanity.
Yeah,
you know, in this case, you're women. In other cases, it's minorities that you're not You're not around and morally questionable. You are actively engaged in a morally despicable program to turn the country against marginalized groups. And then you are issuing an outcry for yourself. And it's just, it's so hypocritical.
With really expensive parachutes, I might add. But I...
Yeah, and it's just...
Look, I'm not here to defend these people as people. Not that
I know you're not
confused.
But all I'm saying is, it was really hard for me to think of them as victims.
Yes,
even though they are victims.
Yeah, to me, I was able to compartmentalize that some. And I think the movie makes two cases. One, particular Gretchen Carlson in particular, I think seemed to be a person who wanted to tell more and better stories on that network, and there wasn't necessarily a place for her.
But doesn't that make it worse?
And I think,
I mean,
but
to
I,
me,
but I
that
also
makes
think
it
that
worse because she's so aware of the damage she's doing that she's trying to mitigate it on air in various ways.
Maybe,
and,
but I think the larger case, if I could make this is the larger point I sort of wanted to make, was that yes, these people were active participants, and I'm not going to say no, they didn't have a choice. But I guess what I would say is, it seemed like it. You know, if you were a woman, and this was your entry point into television, no one else is going to hire you anywhere afterwards. And this was the culture that you sort of just had to find some way to go along with if you wanted to be on TV. You know what I mean? There were some active choices being made, but also some implicit coercion happening simultaneously.
I guess, but I mean, I feel like I'm intimately, like, I understand that choice pretty well in my own life.
Yep.
And I would quit so far before it got to that point, like, so far. I would refuse to say those things on any air, like, years before. I can't wrap my head around it. I want to be on TV so bad that I'm willing to poison the audience.
I don't know. It's hard for me to have this discussion without just veering out of the toy department.
Yeah.
I do think that, you know, trying to look at this from an empathetic standpoint, that I do think that they're right. Like, we have to say that there is a reasonable... It's possible to be a reasonable person with conservative views, right? Like, there is a space somewhere. I'm not saying that the people, that's necessarily exemplary of these people in the movie, or Megyn Kelly in particular, but that...
Well, I mean, Fox News just isn't that at all.
Right.
Fox News is insincere.
But what I'm saying...
Whole building.
Right, but what I'm saying is like, if you are that... To me, I can very much see how a reasonable person with conservative views could wind up working there, you know, because it's their only alternative, and then get sort of sucked into that vortex. I guess that's the point I'm making without going any deeper into just, you know, what makes a good person and a bad person. You know what I mean?
That is fair, undoubtedly. There's no question that's true. But... I mean, Gretchen Carlson worked at Fox News for, what, 15 years?
Yeah, I mean, look, she was on Fox and Friends. So, like, you know, at least a time.
Yeah,
so.
She started on Fox News in 2005, did Fox and Friends until 2013, and then had her own show until 2016 when... the lawsuit happened and she settled September 2016.
Yeah.
So for 11 years, and frankly, until her contract was not renewed, she suffered through abuse she should not have had to suffer through, but B, pushed a horrifying agenda on television without any... Like, yeah, the three times we saw her doing a TV bit in the movie, she was trying to be less of a jerk. But that is not representative of her career.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, probably. Like, I'm not arguing with you, but I also say, how much do you and I really know about what Gretchen Carlson said in her career?
I know she was on Fox for 11 years.
That's all I know, is that she was on Fox for 11 years, and I'm just sort of filling in blanks from there. You know what I mean?
Well, like, so. Even if you take the movie's word for it, that three times she tried to be less of a total dirtbag, the network shut her down. So she obviously wasn't doing it regularly. Like, I don't think there's any question that 90% of the words that came out of her mouth for 11 years were disgusting, you know? And it's just, again, there's a difference between the real world of what should happen in involving these people and whether or not this makes a good subject for a movie addressing the very serious problem of workplace sexual misconduct.
Right.
You know, I am in no way saying these women should not have gotten what they got. Gretchen Carlson probably deserves more than $20 million for what she went through. And she deserves that. And I'm glad that justice was served in some small way by her, you know, effectively winning, although it was a settlement, that lawsuit.
Right.
I just don't know that she makes a sympathetic character in any way.
I don't know that is the movie asking for it you to sympathize like with her necessarily.
It felt to me like they wanted me to ignore, like with Margot Robbie. Again, it's unconscionable what happened to that woman. She deserves every bit of justice she can get. And I just struggle to feel bad for someone who's desperate
yeah,
masses via Fox News.
I don't think you have to feel bad.
She literally says it.
I think that you can separate the humanness, you know what I mean? That she worked at this place. They mistreated her because she was a woman and threw her away like a piece of garbage, basically. And be happy that she got revenge for that without necessarily saying that she's a good person, right? You know what I mean? Or
yes.
That she was doing good
and
things.
And that's all how I feel. That's all true. And I'm just not sure that that's the movie I would have wanted.
Hmm. If we're just getting back to the movie part of it, forgetting about the subtext or the, like, I thought it was a really well done movie with a really deep cast. You know what I mean? Like, there were a great bench of supporting players in this movie. It's hard to portray someone who is like was on television up until last year, you know what I mean? And like Charlize just nails that Megyn Kelly, like you forget. And that's a tough trick to pull off to me.
She became Megyn Kelly.
Yeah.
For sure. It might as well have been Megyn Kelly as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So for that reason alone I think it's worth seeing. I understand your viewpoint, and I'm not going to say you shouldn't feel the way that you feel.
And I wouldn't tell someone not to watch it. It's just that, I was not left afterwards with, and maybe this is what the movie wants. I was not left afterwards with righteous fury about women being mistreated. I was left confused about how I felt about the specific women in the movie.
Hmm. All right. I'm happy that they brought that guy down for even, beyond the stuff, it was a nice side benefit of the fact that, the guy went down for what he deserved to go down for, but the fact that he built a propaganda machine that,
that still
poisons us to this day. Yeah. You know, like whatever, it made us come up. It's a little sweeter. All right. Because we should move on if we want to keep this a mini episode. I am quite curious as to what you thought of Zoe's extraordinary playlist.
Can you go first?
Sure. My first thought while watching this was, I wonder what the pitch for this was like. Like, did NBC buy the concept, or was there a script? Because I get the appeal of this concept, and I can almost hear the elevator pitch of like, we got this kooky idea and we're going to be able to do a mini musical every week, and it's going to be a little bit like Glee, and we're going to get some interesting people and have some zany comedy, but like, there's a really high degree of difficulty to this script the way it's written, and the batting average was not quite high enough for my liking, at least in this pilot.
Okay. I have complicated feelings here.
Okay.
Neither of us love like musicals in general.
Yes. To me, this is also it's an interesting sort of test of my musical hatred, right? Because my big thing about musicals is that it's completely implausible that people just start singing and doing dance numbers out of the middle of nowhere. And this sort of is a cheat around that, right?
Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah, it still finds it marginally. I still find it marginally annoying, though, much like she does. Well,
yeah. So I think this show could go two different ways. And let me start by saying, in a weird way, I kind of loved it. But it could go one of two ways. It can go, although, like you mentioned, there's sort of a cheat around the just everyone bursts into song for no reason thing. It can go the sort of I'm just a musical television show route and lean into the cheesiness and roll with the dance numbers and do more big group stuff. Or and just that it was sort of right on the razor's edge between these two options in the pilot. The other option is, and I don't watch this show as much as I think you do, but like I'm just going to call it the crazy ex-girlfriend option, where
I don't. Yeah, I didn't. I watched a few of those, and I didn't get past season two. I don't think so.
Okay, but I'm just saying, like, where everything's kind of tongue in cheek, and the lead character is kind of making fun of the musical part of it, because like there's the scene in the pilot of Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist where the like her coworkers do the "all I do is win" thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's totally absurd, completely ridiculously over the top. And I don't know if she leaned into it quite hard enough, but the reaction of the main character is like, seriously, these fucking guys, you know? And at one point she's like, oh great, a dance break, you know? And like, yeah, sort of sarcastic, sardonic, like if it leans into that side of it, where she is baffled and also kind of making fun of the insanity that's going on in her brain or around her or however you want to say it, I can get through the cheesy stuff with her dad and that, like the hard melodrama here, if they keep it really funny.
Yeah.
And it wasn't exceptionally funny in the pilot, but there are some seeds where I'm like, this the lead girl has the ability to react to the musical insanity around her either with like a sarcastic, sardonic confusion or with like a deep musical sincerity.
Yeah.
And I think the first one's a good show and the second one is a network show that I don't want to watch.
Well, I think there's something else here too. And this is sort of what I mean by the high degree of difficulty. Like, the pilot makes it hard. You know, it's like, you put this Peter Gallagher character in a coma or whatever it is. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, they didn't hire Peter Gallagher for a non-speaking role. So it's like,
right.
You know, why write him into this thing where you're going to have to somehow bring him back to life?
But I do wonder if he's going to come back to life or if he's just going to sing once or twice once every episode.
Yeah,
or two.
I did sort of think that. I'm like, oh, man, are they just going to like have him do imaginary duets? That will be This Is Us level melodrama. But I, the other thing that I think was hard in the degree of difficulty is that, you know, when it's not doing the musical set pieces, I really think it's going for that, like the Sorkin-esque pitter patter. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
so much.
Like these, the script is written hard.
But I will say, I love The Neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah. And I
don't know who she is. She looks vaguely familiar to me. I forgot to look it up, but like, if you're going to make a, you know, slightly cheesy, Alex Newell is her name. Where have I seen her before though? Oh yeah. She was Unique. Oh, you know what? he.
I was wondering about that. I actually did was sort of wondering about that. I'm like, but anyway.
I don't know if he, I guess he's just playing a lady. He's not transitioning. I don't think.
What did you think, speaking of, that's maybe a nice transition, what did you think of the San Francisco-ness of this show? Because obviously they, you know, there's this the huge set piece in North Beach that I actually think as these things sort of go is pretty realistic. Like it's, you know, half the time you see a movie about San Francisco and they're in one part of the city and then they take 10 steps and they're in a total another part of the city. Like this seemed like a real measured like a Hollywood dance number shot in like Columbus Circle. And I
but then they magically transported to like the top of a hill somewhere from Columbus Circle. So it was pretty I mean it was pretty bullet as far as jumping around San Francisco goes.
I don't think it was because, you know, I used to live in that neighborhood and I was like, I know exactly where they are. This whole there are some hills there.
But then they run down that one hill that's like
right. I think the back of that neighborhood is Lombard, right?
No, I think.
Oh, no, you're right. That's Russian Hill. Never mind. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, right. Fair enough. They're hopping around. It's not as bad as some, but they're definitely hopping around. But look, I love San Francisco. I love the Bay Area and I love seeing it portrayed on TV, even if it's done somewhat inaccurately.
But it's pretty clear that the interiors are not shot in the city. So I like, are they going to really try to do a big musical outdoor set piece every week? That seems unlikely to me.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but I enjoy it. I even enjoy the B-roll of the Golden Gate Bridge. I love this place, man.
Yeah. It really, and it looks, the city looks so great on film. So
it's great.
I hope there are more real shots.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
It looks really great. There's a lot about this series that I like, but I am very conscious that by episode 3, I could be totally over it.
Yeah, I was going to say, but you're planning to watch episode 2.
I think so. I think me and the wife are going to dig in.
All right. I don't, I'm a little on the fence. I certainly, if someone was like, hey, you want to watch this? I would watch it. I don't know that I'm necessarily going to seek it out.
This is not me saying everybody go watch Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist.
Yeah.
But I am saying there was enough in the pilot to keep me intrigued.
All right. Real quick, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. We wrapped up season 3. I think when we left this, I think we were a little bit worried. Not worried, but just felt like the show was sort of settling into what it is. And maybe this season wasn't quite as good as the prior two. But, you know, not bad. Just not quite as good. And I don't know. I think I still feel that way at the conclusion of it.
I am getting mileage out of all of the small things I love about this show.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
I'm not sure there's a great defense. That's not the right word. I'm not sure there's a great reading of this season that makes it like a overarchingly a thing that's important in any way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
The first season of this show felt groundbreaking and new and exciting and it's kind of important, you know, in as much as like a pretty light television show can be. It's just not it knows what it is and it knows the quirks that people enjoy about it, and it's just leaning hard into those, and I that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's Gilmore Girls, right? You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly. And I think we'll get another season of it, and I'll watch that.
We'll certainly get another. In fact, I feel like they may have greenlighted another season of it already.
And I'll watch that, but I won't be quite as fired up as I've been for the past ones.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And Mandalorian. I'm not quite as enthusiastic about Mandalorian as I was when we first talked about it, but not in any kind of real major way for me. It was good. It's good Star Wars stuff. Good Star Wars content. Certainly my favorite Star Wars content this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's weird because in some ways having the stupid Skywalker thing makes you realize how good The Mandalorian is, relatively speaking.
Yes.
On the other hand, I feel like just the rottenness of the main Star Wars product drags the Mandalorian down a little.
I completely get what you mean.
Yeah, it's just like you. It's like my Star Wars excitement balloon was deflated somewhat. No fault of the Mandalorian, but it kind of, I think, affects the Mandalorian a little bit. I gotta say, as a series in the Star Wars universe, I have zero complaints about the Mandalorian.
Yeah, I have no complaints.
I thought it was well done, well acted, interesting guest spots, well told story. It holds together and makes sense, and I would totally watch more of it.
And it doesn't look like Star Wars on a budget, by the way, right?
Which a TV series could easily. Like, you know. Yeah, it looks like a Jon Favreau project, yeah. Which they look amazing, you know? And I have even more respect for him than I did, which was a lot. But I agree with you that, like, my level of excitement waned slightly. And I don't think it has anything to do with The Mandalorian.
Yeah, you may be right about that. And look, and I think the lesson, and I think maybe we even talked about this in the discussion of Skywalker, is that the people directing these things matter, you know?
Yes. So. Yeah. Writers and directors are very important.
Yeah, as it turns
and,
out.
I mean, I think Favreau wrote the whole thing and directed about half of it, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And, like, the guy's just good at this.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope, I'd like to see them give him more to do if he wants to do it. Yeah. All right. We are going to kind of pass a little bit on homework this week. We'll maybe tweet out some stuff during the week to watch. But, you know, it's NFL playoff season. We're busy.
Yeah, man. Who you got? Who do you got?
Look, I think that I think I'm taking Niners and Seahawks in the NFC and the favorites in the. I guess those are all. No, yeah, it's three or four.
No,
favorites.
Seahawks are dogs.
Yeah, and then I'll take the favorites in the AFC.
Yeah.
I feel like the AFC games may not be close.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you, and I'm now less confident. Even less confident than I was. Because I just... Like, consensus in the NFL playoffs makes me ultra nervous.
Me too. And look, mostly because I think it would torture me. I think there's a real possibility that the Vikings win. The Vikings Packers NFC title game would be maximum torture for me, and so then I'm certainly not underestimating the possibility.
You're not even a Bears fan. What are you talking about?
Yeah, for both of us, right? So doesn't it seem likely that would happen? Yeah.
But I kind of think they're both like okay. I can't. And I've watched a lot of Vikings football and every minute of Niners football. And I cannot come up with a storyline for how the Vikings win, honestly.
It's heavy dose of Dalvin Cook, and they come up with a game plan that keeps Kirk relatively clean. That's the script, isn't it? They get some pressure on the quarterback.
You have to believe either of those things, not just either, but both of those things could happen at once. And I can't, based on what I know about both teams, I can't imagine either of those things.
But when you said the same, wouldn't you said the same going into that Saints game?
No. No. Because the Saints defense is nothing like the Niners defense.
But the Saints defense is I'm not going to say they're the Niners defense, but they're pretty good.
They're pretty good, but they lost their best defensive lineman a couple weeks ago, and I don't know. And frankly, they should have won that game. If Drew Brees doesn't fumble for the first time in like a year and a half, they win.
Drew Brees was an abomination in that game.
It's one of the worst games of his career, and they still should have won.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't believe that was a game where the Vikings proved something. I believe it was a game where the Saints piddled down their leg.
So your feelings about Kirk Cousins are no different after that game than they were before.
Ask me if I respect Kirk Cousins.
Do you respect Kirk Cousins?
No, and you can't make me respect Kirk Cousins. I don't care what happened for 1 week in a mediocrely played playoff game. You can't make me respect a guy when I've watched his entire career and he's not good. He's not good.
I asked that question as you know, as though I felt a certain way, but I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that people love to rewrite history after one good week, and it's just not how the world is. So, yeah.
Look, Tony Romo won possible. Playoff games too, right?
Yeah,
I think he did. I might have that wrong.
Anything's possible, man. And like I said, consensus in the playoffs makes me very nervous. So of course it's possible the Vikings could win, but I just don't see a reasonable way for that to happen.
Yeah,
something nuts has to happen in my mind.
I'm excited for the other game in that. Seattle and Green Bay games tend to be nuts, and Seattle versus Green Bay games are pretty much always nuts, and I don't see any scenario in which this game isn't just wild and weird. So I'm excited about that. Of all the games, are you the most sure of Kansas City and Houston? I feel like that's the one where I'm like, I would just be stunned if Houston wins that game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, I think that's the. I mean, it's one of the two biggest spreads, certainly, right? Yeah. I believe there's two 10-point spreads, and that's one of them. The thing about the Titans, though, who are also 10-point dogs, although I think that one may have moved to a half point or so, is it's just that it's hard to blow them out.
Yeah, sure is.
Because of the way they play, it's just hard to win by 10. I don't think it's weird. That's a game where, like, I think the Titans have almost no chance of winning, but a very good chance of covering.
Hmm.
The Texans, I think that's the game that's most a real blowout.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, me too.
Like, I actually think that the Niners are going to handle the Vikings, but I can't see the Niners scoring 35 points against the Vikings. So I think it's like a 24-6 type of blowout.
Wow.
If the Texans play for instance, the way they played last week, they'll be down 30-0 at halftime.
Correct. Correct. It seems pretty obvious that Kansas City has a gear that the Texans don't possess to me. But you know, we'll see if they get to activate that gear or not, though, you know what I mean?
Right. JJ Watt looked good last week. Deshaun Watson has that gear too. It's just it seems to take him 2 or 3 quarters to get it revved up and get the rest of the team playing with him. And I don't know how much you put on a quarterback versus the coach when a team is regularly looks like they don't know what they're doing. And I think it's mostly the coach in this case, but Deshaun Watson has to take some responsibility for failing on offense for an entire half repeatedly.
It does seem to happen a lot. The Bill O'Brien thing is weird. Like, it's hard for me to think of, and I'm sure there are examples, but it's hard to me to think of a coach who has a greater record of success that I feel less confident in than Bill O'Brien. Like, that guy's won the division for the last 5 years, and yet it continually seems like he has no idea what he's doing.
He also sort of resurrected Penn State.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a short run, but it was a good run.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's a very strange phenomenon because I certainly understand if you're Bill O'Brien, what you'd be like, why don't people respect me? You know, like.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to me to be the sort of guy who's not too bad at running the operation week to week and like midweek. Yeah. And then just has some real deficiencies.
Just needs
when
some
it comes to
help on game day.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I mean, that the. The fourth quarter of that Buffalo Houston game, like, was just the head scratching decision after head scratching decision. Like, how the Bills managed to tie that game after that 4th and 27? Like, what are you doing?
Unbelievable!
I can't believe that worked out for them.
And Josh Allen made a lot of the boneheaded decisions on the Buffalo side,
yeah.
But on the Texan side, it seemed to be coaching.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Well, congrats to us because there's no booger and test this week. And
yeah, that'll be good. And, you know, games. I feel a little bad for Booger because I think he has a shot to be good at this. But it's a funny thing about broadcasting. A lot of times you say stupid stuff, not because you're stupid and don't understand it, but because you're like broadcasting and it's hard, right? And Booger has a propensity 1 to 5 times a game to say something completely inane and that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But I don't think those mistakes are generally reflective of your football knowledge, right? Like that's a broadcasting mistake, not a football mistake. And I actually think his football acumen is good. He's just very raw. And the problem with those mistakes is they don't actually matter, but people freak out.
Yeah, they do. And look, my sense of that whole thing is that it's the production. It's the people, the support around that team, because we've seen a lot of people in that booth for a long time. It's continually bad. You feel bad for Booger. I feel bad for Tess. Tess was an excellent college football announcer. Excellent.
Yeah, he's not built for the pros, man.
Yeah, but he just seems a fish out of water here, you know.
The level of it, he has, like, his excitement barometer is broken.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild that we've gotten to a place where like Joe Buck is the guy that you should like look at in terms of understanding the moment and feel for it and how much enthusiasm to give. But I kind of think we're there.
I don't think that's wild at all.
He used to really underplay it. Really underplay it. He was doing a summer all by his own admission.
Yes. But it's better to underplay it than overplay it.
Yeah.
He was always with guys who played it just fine. If you're the play-by-play guy, stay cool, man. The only brutal broadcasting mistake on Joe Buck's resume, as far as I'm concerned, is the Moss mooning, where he just went strangely insane.
Yeah.
Especially when, if you've ever talked to Joe Buck, like in an interview or just like a hallway, he's not a prude. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, he clearly thought... The NFL wants me to react this way.
Yeah.
And he was wrong.
Yep. And by the way, it's like, that was one of those things for me. Cause up until that point, I was like, this guy's like one of us. He's like my age. He likes Pearl Jam. Right. He cracks jokes. Right. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh no, he's not. He's carrying water for the league. And look, I think as time has gone by and he's, you know, had so many big games and moments since then, it's like, whatever. Like, yeah, I thought that was a terrible moment. It was 20 years ago. He and Randy get on fine. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, he's in a good place. I just think he is as good a play describer in both baseball and football as anyone I have ever watched.
Yeah. If you're holding Randy Moss against him at this point, like, I'm not defending him, obviously. I still think it was terrible.
No, you just don't like him.
Yeah, if you're holding that against him 20 years later, that's on you. That's not a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, and so to me, he and Al Michaels are the gold standard for football play-by-play as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I'd agree with that. And look, I'm not a huge Jim Nance fan. He's a golf guy, so you can tell how I feel. But he's certainly capable he's and competent and works real hard and is super professional. Yes. So I got nothing bad to say about Jim Nance.
He's a pro, and you know, we actually talked about this on the radio over the last couple of weeks because of the Romo stuff. You know, his contract is up.
Yeah. He's not at all afraid to let Romo shine, which I think is really cool, by the way.
That's what I was just going to say is I think there's a good chance Romo ends up somewhere else, perhaps Monday Night Football. He's going to be paid a ridiculous amount of money, and he deserves it. He's awesome at the job. But if I was his cousin who he asked for advice, I would tell him to be careful what you wish for as far as a new play-by-play partner goes, because Jim Nance is the perfect compliment.
Yeah,
He's ultra calm. He doesn't care about letting the spotlight go on the other guy, and it's the perfect foil for Romo's excitement.
I'd be willing to wager money that team's together for a long time. I don't see him leaving. But
I don't know what his plans are. I'm just saying, like, if I was giving him advice, I would say – you've got it really good right now, buddy.
Yep.
Really good in terms of a partner.
I think he knows that, and I think they get along really well outside the booth from what I hear. So, because they're both golf guys at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's true. Romo is as much a golf guy as a football guy.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Our mini episode is now clocking in at 49 minutes, so we should get the hell out of here.
That's still relatively mini. We'll update you if we come up with any homework over the course of the week, and if not – I guess next week will be a big surprise. It'll be exciting.
Yep. Okay, say bye.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.